If you are close to retirement or recently retired, you can't afford to miss this commercial. What if I told you one of the biggest dangers to running out of money in retirement was a risk you've never heard of before? If you've never heard of sequence of return risk, please check out the trailer at sequenceofreturnrisk.com. And remember, an investment in knowledge pays the best interest. Benjamin Franklin.
Hey everyone, it's Tim Pichot. This is the Libertarian Advisor Podcast. Right now, we are going to talk about Bitcoin versus Bitcoin Cash. It's been a hot subject in the news lately. Yesterday, Coinbase, the largest U.S. exchange, decided to add Bitcoin Cash to their lineup. So right now, you can get Bitcoin, Bitcoin Cash, Ethereum, and Litecoin through Coinbase, which is the largest U.S. exchange. Now, that news, I was at dinner yesterday talking about Bitcoin Cash with one of my friends. And apparently that's right when it got added yesterday, because it exploded to the roof. It went up like 70-80% in one day. So it's just bonkers. But a lot of people have been asking me, you know, what is the difference between Bitcoin and Bitcoin Cash? Is Bitcoin Cash just some sort of people that cloned Bitcoin and then hijacked it and is trying to use the brand name? Or what's really going on here? So what I want to do is I want to dispel some of the myths and some of the rumors about what's really going on. And it's probably a little bit hard to see. Well, especially if you guys are listening to me right now, it'd be impossible to see. But I have a little whiteboard. And what I have on the whiteboard is something to represent what Bitcoin is, and then another picture that's going to represent what Bitcoin Cash is. But first, what I want to do is I want to go back to the fork that happened on August 1st. And basically, this worked a lot like a stock exchange. So think of it this way. If you had one Bitcoin prior to August 1st, you would then have one Bitcoin Cash when things fork. So if you had one Bitcoin, now you'd have one Bitcoin Cash and one Bitcoin. So, you know, not too much risk in terms of, you know, one exploding and the other one dying and you missing the boat on that. You know, as long as you didn't sell, you wouldn't miss the boat on anything. You'd have both of them. So what Bitcoin attempted to do is they wanted to do something called segregated witness. And actually, by attempted to do this, they've already done this. And so what segregated witness does is it takes some of the data, which was the signature in this case, which is what they call the witness, and they put it on a different block. So right now, that signature would take about, I think it's about 60% of the overall data is in that signature. So it's really, when you only have one megabyte block, you're going to need. And now that the fact that Bitcoin has really exploded in popularity, it's creating a problem, because imagine that you've got a glass and, you know, all of a sudden your glass is overflowing. That's sort of like the Bitcoin transactions right now. They're overflowing. There's hundreds of thousands of transactions that are unconfirmed. And how they go about confirming these transactions is, you know, hey, if you're willing to pay $20, then maybe you get in. And if you're willing to pay, you know, $2, then maybe you're not going to get in. And I just checked this a little while ago, and let's check it right now. But the Bitcoin average fee was somewhere around $32, which is just absolutely insane, because, you know, it used to be like more like 30 cents or even $3. I thought that was high, but now we're at $32. It's absolutely insane. So what Bitcoin did is they really wanted to lay the groundwork for something called the Lightning Network. And SegWit would allow them to lay this groundwork for Lightning Network. So the reason why Bitcoin, so there was two, if I back it up a second again, there was two basically main ways to scale Bitcoin. One was to do this, excuse my language, is clusterfuck known as segregated witness and then the Lightning Network. And then the other way was just to say, hey, we've got, you know, we're only dealing with 1 megabyte blocks. All we're going to do is just increase the block size to 8 megabytes. Problem solved. So in order to do any of these changes, what you have to do is you have to get consensus from 95% of all the parties involved. So, you know, the miners, the nodes, the users would then, you know, obviously be able to vote with their wallets. And that's what we kind of saw a little bit yesterday. So it's very, very hard to get 95% consensus. I mean, if you think that, you know, when I started getting into and basically just covering crypto and moving away from politics, I thought that, okay, great, I'm moving away from politics, I don't need to deal with any of this bullshit anymore. Wrong. Because there's plenty of politics that are in Bitcoin. And so the people, you know, they've called it big blockers, and I'm saying this in quotes right now. So on the one camp, you had the people that wanted to make the block bigger. On the other camp, you had the people that wanted to do this segregated witness. So the people that wanted to make the block bigger, they realized, you know, we're never going to get 95% consensus. We know that this other way that they're going to do it is not going to work, or it's certainly not going to work in the way that they say it's going to work. So we're going to go and we're going to fork Bitcoin and create Bitcoin Cash. So what they're doing is they took a 1 megabyte block and simply made it 8 megabytes. The people over at Bitcoin SegWit, or what now is referred to as Bitcoin Core, what you would also refer to as Bitcoin, what they did is they took that data, put it on a separate block, completely changing the entire landscape and entire architecture of what Bitcoin is, where, you know, for all intents and purposes, Bitcoin is dead. There is the Bitcoin that Satoshi Nakamoto rolled out in 2009 is not the Bitcoin that we have now, because by having these extended blocks, it's making way for this Lightning Network. And what the Lightning Network is going to do is, in essence, create these hubs. So instead of, you know, me trading with you, it's saying, okay, well, you know, if you and I trade, you know, with each other quite frequently, then what we can do is open up this, you know, this basically network where, you know, we only have to pay one transaction fee. And then when we eventually close things out, then we can settle up. So let's say, you know, I'm Mike, or I'm Tim, my brother's Mike. So, you know, we, you know, buy each other drinks and go out to, you know, restaurants together. And so instead of, you know, so maybe, you know, we put up, you know, 2 Litecoin. So today, you know, that'd be $600. And so, you know, I take him out for a night and, you know, he owes me, let's say $100. So then he can send over the appropriate Litecoin. Then, you know, maybe he takes me to a sporting event and then I send over back the appropriate Litecoin. And so all the while we're not having to actually spend that much. And sorry, I'm kind of jumping around the Litecoin, but this is getting into where Bitcoin is going with all this. And so what they're trying to do is they're trying to say, you know, if we create these hubs, then what's going to happen is, you know, you're going to cut down on transaction fees because you're only going to have to pay the fee when you settle things up. Now, what if I then want to then, you know, then send one over to Bob? Well, if I don't have a connection with Bob, well then what they're saying is, oh, well, Mike has a connection with Bob. So then through, you know, through this, you know, network of, basically, it's super, super complicated of how they're trying to do this. But what the groundwork that they're laying out for is they're going to have the hub be the banks. It's so obvious that it's not even funny. So segregated witness allows for all the KYC, so know your customer, allows for all the anti-money laundering laws. Not that that's necessarily a bad thing at certain levels, but when it comes to peer-to-peer transactions, if you're having to go through a bank, you're no longer in a peer-to-peer transaction. And if you look at actual Satoshi Nakamoto's white paper, I believe it was called Bitcoin, peer-to-peer electronic cash, or it was something along that lines, but it was peer-to-peer. And so if you're having Lightning Network, you're completely getting rid of the peer-to-peer. And so what I see is that the big banks have completely come in to hijack Bitcoin. And you're probably thinking, oh yeah, that sounds kind of crazy. I mean, if they're going to hijack Bitcoin, you know, what would they have to do? They'd have to take over the core development. And for some of you, you're probably thinking core development, you know, Bitcoin has a core development. They do. They have a core development. It's really kind of secretive of, you know, all the people that are in it, you know, how they get together. I mean, it's bad enough we have a Federal Reserve Board, let alone that now that we have this other network. And I've got my wife call me in and I just told her not to call me. So that I was doing this. But anyways, with Bitcoin, with this Lightning Network, I just absolutely see it laying the groundwork to put the banks in between you and Bitcoin. And how it got hijacked is through the core development, because the core development team, if you really look at it, because like me, I follow the money, that's what I do. And so the money comes from the fact that you had a company called AXA, so AXA, the largest insurance conglomerate in the world. And what they did is they made a $55 million investment. I believe it was somewhere around about there, to this company Blockstream. And Blockstream were the ones who were funding all of the core developers. So in the beginning, you had a lot of people who were more of the hardcore libertarians, people that were, you know, philosophically very, you know, more of like a leave me aloneist, you know, almost, you know, anarcho-capitalist was the original coders. Now you've got a lot of money introduced and you've got people that are basically just shills for the big banks. And so I didn't even tell you the craziest part of this story yet, because the story gets really crazy, because AXA, the head of AXA up until recently, was Henry de Castries. Henry de Castries also was the chairman of the Bilderberg Steering Committee on 2 separate occasions. So, you know, when it comes to, you know, conspiracy theories, I mean, you don't have to go too far to see the fact that basically the Bilderberg Group has its hands inside of Bitcoin. Now, maybe that's me just being a little bit too paranoid or conspiratorial, but, you know, if Bitcoin was meant to supplant the banks, if Bitcoin was meant to be a way where I can send something of value to you, and nobody can stop that. Well, now if I have to go through a Lightning network, well, then now there's someone that could stop me. And then we're right back to basically a bank. So, I mean, basically replace the word bank or, you know, hub with a bank, and that's what we're going to get. And I'm not going to, and I'm not here saying that, you know, there aren't some benefits to a Lightning network. Like, so in the example where I'm trading with my brother, yeah, in that instance, I could see where that be could be pretty useful. But once you start getting into, you know, all these, you know, let's say fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth generations down the line of, you know, Mike knows Bob, who knows Joe, who knows Fred, who knows Tom. And so we're going through all these, you know, rapid gyrations to get the money back between Tim and Mike. It's just absolutely crazy. So when you look at, you know, who forked who, I'm really of the opinion that on August 1st, it was really more along the lines of Bitcoin Core, the, you know, Bitcoin BTC, that they're the ones who actually, you know, really staged a coup. But this is stuff that's really inside baseball. It's really over the head of probably 99% of the public. It's probably over the head of most people who even have Bitcoin right now. And so you see these people who they call themselves Bitcoin maximalists, where it's a, you know, Bitcoin or die. Bitcoin was first, so Bitcoin has to be the best. Well, Bitcoin got hijacked by the Bilderberg Group, and that's very, very obvious. And everything they're trying to do right now is to shoehorn Bitcoin into the legacy banking system. And so you've seen a lot of personal attacks on people in this movement. So one of the most prominent people in this movement would be Roger Ver. Roger Ver is also known as Bitcoin Jesus. And he also is, you know, he has Bitcoin.com, Bitcoin.org, all of his network, his first investor in Bitcoin. And really, he probably has the most to lose out of anybody of this, because if he were to just go along to get along, if he were to just embrace everything they're doing over at Bitcoin, he could probably even enjoy even a bigger payday. He could, you know, he's got a lot riding on this. So when I see a guy like him, you know, really stake his net worth, stake his claim, stake his name and everything else to then go ahead and do Bitcoin Cash, a lot of people are looking at that and saying, you know, he's selfish, and how dare he, you know, clones Bitcoin and rips it off, and it's brand mark infringement. And they don't know this whole other story that's behind it. And when you really get down to, you know, I guess brass tacks is what you'd call it, and think about, you know, the usability of Bitcoin and after the fork, you know, let's see where the rubber meets the road. You guys implemented this segregated witness to bring down fees. Where are the fees today? They're at $32. I almost wanted to drop a F-bomb there, but they're at $32. Where's the fees for Bitcoin Cash? It's like 27 cents. So you guys implemented this whole cluster you-know-what over here at Bitcoin. It actually raised the fees of Bitcoin, and then Bitcoin Cash, what they did, actually lowered the price of Bitcoin. So right now, you know, it's either put up or shut up right now for the Bitcoin people or Bitcoin Core people, because their solution right now has not worked. And so one of my theories is that a lot of people who have bought Bitcoin recently, they've never actually traded it with anybody. They've never actually transacted. They've never purchased anything with it. And so I did a little experiment and went over to some of my business partners and said, hey, you know, you guys have some crypto. Have you actually, you know, sent it to anybody? And they're like, no, you know, we're just on Coinbase, or we're just on Kraken or whatever. And so I did a little experiment where I sent $1 of Litecoin to one of my buddies that I work with, and, you know, got the transaction super quickly. And, you know, I think it cost like a quarter to do. And there's other wallets where it would probably even cost less than that. Now, that dollar I sent them within like 3 days turned into like $3. So, you know, maybe I should have waited three days, but, you know, who cares? But yeah, so I think it was right when the price went from 100 to like 330 within the span of like 4 or 5 days, just absolutely nuts. But where I'm getting at all this is that Roger Ver had a lot to lose by jumping off the Bitcoin bandwagon that he was basically, you know, customer number one to, from an investment standpoint. And then now to see all these people really just bastardizing his name, and people saying, you know, oh, you know, he's a felon and he's not allowed in America. Well, I mean, I saw him like 2 or 3 months, I'm not friends with him or anything, but, you know, I did see him speak a couple of months ago at the Nexus Earth conference. So, you know, the fact that he's banned from America, I mean, I just, unless that's recent, I was at one point 2 feet away from him a couple of months ago. So I don't really think that is the case. And then his felony was, you know, he was speaking out against the government, and then they caught him in like 95 selling firecrackers on the internet, and he was basically the only person to ever go to jail for that. And so, you know, if people want to start using, you know, this guilt by association technique, they really better be careful, because it's the same guilt by association technique that everybody else is using against Bitcoin, saying, you know, Bitcoin is the money of terrorists, Bitcoin is the money of drug launderers, Bitcoin's the money of drug dealers, you know, pedophiles, all this other stuff. So now you're trying to say, oh, Bitcoin Cash, it's the, you know, pedophiles use Bitcoin Cash, you know, and this is in regards to Rick Falkvenir of the Icelandic Pirate Party, of comments that he made that were completely taken out of context by the fake news, particularly Business Insider in this case. And really what he said is, the headline was, you know, child porn should be legal. And what all he was saying is, he goes, well, there's laws in Iceland where, let's say I caught somebody engaged in an act with a child, and if I wanted to get some sort of basically proof of it, and maybe, you know, take a 2-second you know, video of it to, as proof to give to authorities under Icelandic law, he could then get into basically go to jail for that. And so now people are spinning this as, you know, Bitcoin Cash, people want, you know, children to be used, you know, in sex slavery and all this other stuff and all this other crap that, you know, really should be way beyond, you know, what the Bitcoin crowd is going through, or the crypto world is going through. And so I'm not really married to any one of these cryptocurrencies. There's 1400 plus of them now. And again, you know, what I want is, I want transactions where it can't be stopped. I want low transaction fees. You know, I'd like to have it anonymous. And right now, Bitcoin is not anonymous. It's not low transaction fees. It's not even quick. I mean, it could take, you know, like a day to send somebody some money. So I don't know. So what they're trying to do is create this massive problem. So it's the Hegelian dialectic of problem, reaction, solution. So they've created the problem. The reaction is, we need to do something about this, which they do. And so the solution is, oh, we've got the Lightning Network, and the Lightning Network will be the banks. And it's very, very obvious that, And I mean, in the banks, you know, want to act like they're against crypto. Guys like Jamie Dimon, or Jamie Dimon, as I like to call him, he likes to act like he's against cryptocurrencies. But Ethereum, they're in the Ethereum Alliance, where they have like, I think it's like 170 something patents on blockchain technology. So on one hand, Jamie Dimon's bad mouthing blockchain, and on the other hand, his company has 170 patents on it. So maybe that's a way to, you know, maybe stop future competition by saying, hey, if we've got the patent on this, then we're going to shut you guys down. But, you know, there's gonna be people who are going to be putting satellites up into space out of Earth's atmosphere that's out of any jurisdiction, that they don't give a shit about your patent. It's going to, unless you're going to take laser beams and start shooting them down, you're not going to be able to stop this stuff. And so, you know, what I see is that the banks are definitely trying to insert themselves into this equation, and really it'd be a dream for the government in this standpoint. And it would also be in some regards be sort of like the Mark of the Beast type network, because now, you know, all of your money through Bitcoin is able to be tracked. You don't necessarily know whose wallet that's on, but, you know, I think there's companies like Dark Data Services, another one that starts, I think it's like Rivets or something, that starts with an R. And there are companies that can do this forensic work. They can go examine IP addresses. There's, you know, if you're on Coinbase, obviously your money's tracked at that point. And so I'm not, you know, over here encouraging anybody does anything illegal or tries hiding profits. But, you know, there is ways where, you know, a lot of people who think they're being anonymous right now are not being anonymous. And a lot of what was sold to the Bitcoin community, particularly the libertarian community back in the beginning, which got this up and running, you know, a lot of it ended up being lies. A lot of it ended up being smoke and mirrors. A lot of it was more of a sales pitch of, well, we didn't really know exactly how it was working, but some really smart people told us it worked this way. They told us it was anonymous. Well, it's pseudo anonymous. And then if you look up, you know, the word pseudo in the dictionary, it means not. So Bitcoin is not anonymous. There's other ones, I think like Zcash, Monero, Dash, and some other ones that are going to be, you know, more anonymous than Bitcoin. And, you know, when it comes to the future, you know, we're going to have two futures, and those futures are going to be, you're going to have digital currency. It's going to be, do you want digital currency that's controlled, Mark of the Beast, tracked, traced, surveilled, run by the government? Or do you want a digital currency like, you know, let's say Monero in this case, where, you know, it's anonymous, can't be tracked, can't be traced, can't be stopped? Because, I mean, just imagine the political dissidents. I mean, imagine if Hillary got in there. I mean, I'd probably be in a FEMA camp right now, but imagine if Hillary got in there and we had a Bitcoin-like system, and all of a sudden Hillary can say, you know, you know, Tim Pichot, he's over there, you know, causing a ruckus, you know, exposing us. We're going to shut off his money. And that's really the danger of where I see all this stuff going. And so I see a lot of people who are very uninformed on this subject who are then literally going to be leading us, marching us into this mark of the beast system. And that's not to discourage you from getting into cryptos, because there's a lot of very, very fine cryptos. And right now I'm in the midst of creating a company built around crypto. And I have crypto in the name, and I have the domain name saved where I could have made it Bitcoin, but I'm not, you know, I really don't have a huge dog in this fight. I'm just going to use what's better. I'm going to invest in philosophy. I'm going to invest in the ones where, you know, basically the different freedom coins. And I don't see Bitcoin as being that. I think it started, I'm glad it's here. I'm glad Satoshi Nakamoto, whoever, you know, he or they or she or whatever cis transgendered person made this up, that I'm glad they did it, but it did get hijacked by the core development, and it got hijacked by, you know, techies who don't necessarily understand economics. And when it comes down to the simple test of if I can send you you know, $50 in Bitcoin Cash and it cost me, you know, a third of a penny, or I can send you $50 in Bitcoin and I've got to pay an extra $25 or right now $32 on top of that, so it's going to cost me $82 versus one that could cost me, you know, $50 and, you know, 20 cents, you know, it's really not that hard of calculus to figure out which one I'm going to want to use. So anyways, that's, you know, my little take on Bitcoin versus Bitcoin Cash. I'm of the opinion, in case you can't tell, that Bitcoin Cash is the real Bitcoin. At the end of the day, I don't really care. And actually, you know, I want to make one other point about the tax proposal. I'm very glad that the rate is getting closer to zero. I think the new plan is a little bit better than the one that was out, you know, a few weeks ago. Not nearly as good as the one that was out in May. But this plan is already obsolete before it even begins, because of exactly everything I'm talking about. And it's not actual reform. The current tax plan is, yes, it's moving the number closer to zero. I'm very happy about that. Fantastic about that. But if we have, you know, Republicans controlling everything, I mean, the best case scenario possible for conservatives, and there's nothing that's being cut from the budget, no chance of the budget being balanced. And I think because of the fact that government can just print money, that there is no reason to even have taxes. If they can just print money to cover the taxes anyways, then why do you need to extort us? And the reason they need to extort us is because it's not about getting the money. It's about having the control. And that's what the taxation system has been about all from the beginning. And actually, that's a little bit not true, because in the beginning of America, the tax system was there to actually, you know, we had real gold and silver. And so people had to, the government needed that gold, the government needed that silver, and to then replenish their stockpiles, because they had the Continental, and that, you know, crashed down to zero. So the founder said, you know, only gold and silver shall be legal tender in America. And now we've gotten so far away from that that I think FDR confiscated the gold in 33, so Americans really couldn't own it, or it wasn't, the dollar wasn't convertible into gold after 33. Then you go back to 1971, that's when Nixon got us off the gold standard from the terms of foreigners at that point weren't allowed to convert their Federal Reserve notes or dollars into gold anymore. So with Bitcoin, you know, why I see this being such, you know, a great advancement, or cryptos in general, why I see this being such a great advancement for humanity, is now all of a sudden we're not being ripped off by the banks who are printing this money. The money is going to the ultra rich first. It's going to people who have money in the stock market first. I manage money for a living. So guess what? That actually helps me out. But I don't want my great-great-grandchildren being slaves to the system. So that's why I'm passionate about it. Or what about all these different wars? You know, if you can't crowdfund a war, if you can't force people to, you know, if not force, if people won't voluntarily give up their own money to go do something, then it's probably a bad idea. Like, I don't need the government putting a gun to my head and then making it sound like I'm giving some sort of charitable contribution. And, you know, the debt right now, it can never be repaid, absolutely never be repaid. But getting back to the tax plan, is we need to have a consumption-based tax. With cryptocurrency exploding, with people having all these gains, it is a tax nightmare right now, especially for the early adopters, an absolute tax nightmare of trying to figure out what their basis is, how do they prove it, you know, that were they buying some things for business, were they mining versus buying Bitcoin, because there's two different forms of taxation on that, did they inherit the Bitcoin? There is so many complications dealing with this, and that's why we need to move to a consumption tax. So, you know, let's say, you know, you're a poor kid from the ghetto and you're buying $200 Jordans. you should get taxed for that because you shouldn't be buying $200 Jordans. What you should be doing is using your money to save and invest for the future. And we maybe in this system, we exempt poor people from this, from at least in terms of, you know, essential goods. But when it comes to when it comes to just the overall economy, we should be encouraging people to save and invest and to make more money. I mean, right now we are taxing people making money. I mean, so how do you expect to get more money in an economy by disincentivizing people to actually work? And so that's why I'm really upset with this tax bill. You know, again, I am a Trump fan. I'm not even sure if I'm going to vote for him next time. Probably not even going to bother even voting because he put Jerome Powell in, and Jerome Powell is basically Janet Yellen 2.0. And so, from my perspective, is let's say there's 1,000 problems out there, and let's say Trump fixes 999. If that one problem that's remaining is the central banking system, and you don't fix that, I don't care about the other 999 things that you've done, because the rest of it doesn't even matter. And that's why with crypto, it's a hedge against all this stuff, because eventually, you know, our day is going to come as a currency. You know, luckily right now there's other currencies that are doing even worse than us. So again, I don't know the exact timing on this. In the interim, the currency might actually get even stronger because of demographic information, but that's a whole nother rabbit trail that I don't feel like going down right now. But in the long run, you can't have, you know, $200 trillion of unfunded liabilities. You can't have $20 trillion of debt that doesn't include Social Security, doesn't include Medicare, that's even more of an unfunded obligation than Social Security, doesn't include the wars, doesn't include healthcare, doesn't include any of that stuff. And so I just see this as a slow motion train wreck that's going to be absolutely devastating. And so, you know, have some money in crypto. Make sure you know how much money you can lose first, because, you know, if you're not willing to have your crypto go down 90%, which actually happened to the Continental, if you're not willing to have it go down 90%, you shouldn't be in it. You should figure out how much you're willing to lose, how much you can stomach losing, how much you can actually afford to lose, and then kind of reverse engineer. But, you know, I think it's also a good idea for people to have, you know, physical gold and silver. Also a good idea for people to have stocks. And you're probably thinking, oh, well, if everything crashes, then, you know, why would I want money in stocks? Well, in Germany, in like the early 1900s, so you go from like 1910 or 1913 to 1923, the German stock market went from just about, you know, like 100, 200 to 23 million. And let's say you own Mercedes stock back then. And so Mercedes, the oldest car company in the world, the Germans went through the Goldmark, the Rennmark, the Reichsmark, and then the Deutschmark. So if you had, you know, $100 sitting in Goldmark, well, eventually you're wiped out and was basically, you know, worth next to nothing. Maybe you get 10 cents in the dollar. Then you had the Reichsmark, same deal. Then you had the Rennmark, then Reichsmark, the same deal. But if you had that 100 shares of Mercedes stock, well, then it was at least then transposed from, you know, well, now my 100 shares are getting priced in this, now it's getting priced in that, now it's getting priced in this, then eventually getting priced in Deutschmark, well, I guess eventually getting priced in euros. And what that is it's a hedge. Now, it doesn't mean that the average citizen now all of a sudden in Germany was doing great in 1923. It meant that now they were taking, you know, a wheelbarrow over to go, you know, buy a loaf of bread. And so I think in the long run, in a long enough time horizon, certainly I'm a pretty young guy, so over the course of my lifetime, I think that's more than inevitable, especially if, you know, in the next few years, there's gonna be crazy life extension technology coming out, crazy advancements in the biotech space. So, I mean, if people can live another 10 years, I mean, they might be able to live another 80 at the rate things are going. But at the rate things are going, you know, I don't even know if we want to live another 80. And at the rate things are going, you know, I'm not sure if, you know, we're going to provoke some sort of war over North Korea. Oh, yeah, the big headlines now. You guys see this? North Korea, you know, is apparently amassing stockpiles of Bitcoin. And so, you know, you've got to throw in, you know, you got to give everybody a lot of fear and say, oh, now Bitcoin, that's the money of Kim Jong-un. So we've got to get rid of it. And, you know, absolutely ridiculous. Anyways, at this point, probably rambling on a little more than I'd like to. But, you know, with Bitcoin versus Bitcoin Cash, it's my opinion that Bitcoin Cash is real Bitcoin. It's also my opinion that I don't really care, because I think there's other ones that really do things better than even what Bitcoin Cash does. But at the end of the day, you know, I appreciate what Roger Ver is doing. I think a lot of the people who are in these Bitcoin maximalists, I think a lot of them just don't understand the full story, the full inside baseball, what's going on. And they just think that, you know, that basically Bitcoin Cash is trying to hijack the brand name, when really the core development of Bitcoin, they're the ones who got hijacked. Thanks for watching. Please like and share. I've been somewhat ghosted on Facebook, meaning Facebook, when I go live, doesn't really show it to anybody or shows it to like a super limited amount of people these days. But no, I appreciate everything. Let me know if you have any more questions about this subject. It is pretty complicated. There's lots of different areas that I can go on here. But let me know what you'd like me to talk about, and we'll go from there. Take care, everybody. Thank you.
Hey, you. You may have seen something about Bitcoin a few years back. It sounded revolutionary. This was going to replace the banks. It was permissionless, decentralized, peer-to-peer electronic cash. No one can take it from you. You can send any amount for less than a penny, fast. But damn, the price was $100, and it would probably fail anyways, so you better play it safe and see what happens. Then you saw the price recently on the news, $15,000, and immediately your stomach dropped because you realized that how rich you could have been. But you blew it. But you realize that it's still going up fast, and if you invest now, you're probably still on the ground floor. When you finally get your Bitcoin, after waiting 5 hours for it to confirm, you realize that some is missing. Turns out that your small investment of $30, $15 went towards the transfer fee to put it in your wallet. This is what was going to change the world? Let me fill you in on what happened while you were gone. Transaction fees have risen because of the block size. The block size is 1 megabyte currently and only allows for a few transactions per second to take place. Many more happen than this, so the people who pay the highest fee get to go first in line. On December 12, 2017, at the time I'm recording this video, the average transaction fee today was $24.40. This problem only gets worse with time and as adoption spreads. Instead of raising the block size again, the development team has decided to go for a second layer called the Lightning Network. It promises instant transactions, super low fees, and this is the basics of how it works. Let's say me and you transact regularly, so we open a channel for 2 bitcoins. I send a bitcoin and you send a bitcoin to a multi-signature address, where it's temporarily locked away. Now we are free to trade 2 bitcoins back and forth with no fees, as long as we both sign each transaction. This is because the actual bitcoin was never moved. We are essentially trading for the rights of the coin, off-chain, similar to an IOU. When we close our channel, it settles on the blockchain. Our IOUs are redeemed, and we get our share of the real Bitcoin. The only time the high transaction fee occurs is when you open or close a channel to settle up. You want to transact with somebody you don't have a direct channel open with. Let's say you want to transact with Bob and pay him 1 Bitcoin. Bob does not currently have an open channel with you, and you don't want to have to pay the fees to open another channel. It turns out that my first cousin Sam has an open channel with Bob. You could send the payments through our channel and use the channel I have open with Sam, and finally from Sam to Bob, paying me and Sam very small transaction fees for using our open channels. This is ideally how the network would work, hopping from individual to individual until your transaction meets the intended recipient. But it turns out if Sam isn't as fortunate as us, and our channel only has 0.5 bitcoins deposited, this won't work. There has to be enough loaded on each channel along the way for it to be used, and the network must find another route. Luckily, it turns out that Bob and you both eat at the same pizza shop regularly enough that you both have open channels. The pizza shop has plenty of bitcoin in its channel and is one less hop than the last example. Bob gets paid, less fees for you, and the pizza shop gets a reward for providing a useful service. Everyone wins. Or so it would seem. A problem with the system is the requirement to preload every open channel you have ahead of time, with what you assume will be the upper limit of your spending habits with that channel. It's more convenient to have one open channel and a large amount of Bitcoin to a well-connected party that consistently has more money than you, so you can always route through. This is why hubs will naturally occur. A Lightning hub is a node with enough channels open and enough liquidity available that by connecting them, you limit the amount of channels you need to personally open, never have to worry about their balance, and reduce the amount of hops and fees required to make transactions. Unlike miners, who don't actually transfer value, these hubs will likely be classified as third-party settlement organizations, being subject to heavy financial regulation laws such as KYC and AML. Also, unlike on-chain transactions, there is a chance of theft in this system. If another party attempts to broadcast a channel in an old state, they can try to steal your Bitcoin if you can't catch them in time. For this, you will either need to run a full Bitcoin node that will always be online to monitor the transactions yourself, or hire a third-party service to do this on your behalf. So, the Lightning hubs will require to be set up for financial regulation and reporting laws, require massive amounts of liquidity to keep multiple well-funded open channels, offer fraud departments to watch the blockchain constantly and prevent theft, all while taking small fees for every transaction you route through them. Does this system sound familiar? Just replace the term open channel with checking account. These Lightning Network hubs will be ran by the same financial institutions the Bitcoin was made to challenge. The banks aren't fighting Bitcoin because Bitcoin will be the new banking system. Bitcoin needed no middleman. There was no fraud to detect, no permission to give, no transaction to reverse, no fees to collect. So it had to be broken to need them. And the worst part is, you won't have a choice. Either give up your freedom and use the Lightning Network, or be subject to double or even triple digit ever-increasing fees for every move you make on the blockchain. The truth is, the 1 megabyte blocks restricting Bitcoin are purposely kept there by the developers. The absurdly high fees and long waits create a demand for a solution, and the solution they give us is the banking industry. The block size restriction was placed as a temporary safeguard by Bitcoin's creator, Satoshi Nakamoto. As soon as the blocks were close to being full, it was to be raised again. Satoshi mysteriously left the project in 2010, but before he did, he left instructions on how to raise the block size and left Gavin Anderson in charge of the project. When Satoshi left, institutional money started to make its way in and take control, and a company, Blockstream, emerged. Over time, it happened that a large portion of the development team was part of or hired by this company, and when it came time for another block size increase, there was a portion of the developers that thought this was a bad idea. This just so happened to be the same group of developers that worked for Blockstream. The story of how Blockstream took over is a long and strange one, and I'll have to cover it in another video. But with massive amounts of censorship, organized attacks, and manipulation, Blockstream managed to take primary control over the development of Bitcoin and forced out any of the developers who opposed their choices and gave open arms to the ones whose opinions are aligned. Ever since then, the fees have exponentially risen, the confirmation times have grown from minutes to hours to days, and the merchants are dropping support at a rapid rate. The block size should have been raised long ago. It could be raised for years without any risk of centralization, giving us time to find other solutions. But it won't happen, because Blockstream states that they plan to turn a profit by selling sidechains to businesses, allowing them to accept custom Bitcoin-backed chains that aren't subject to Bitcoin's high fees, taking small fees for every transaction, fixed monthly fees from the businesses, and selling the custom hardware needed to run them. This model is far more profitable if Bitcoin doesn't work properly. If the fees are low and no one wants their sidechains, then how will they pay the $74 million back to the corporations and big bankers who have invested, the ones who benefit from the Lightning Hubs? This amazing technology, designed to give freedom, stability, and power to the people around the world, has been ripped apart and destroyed for power, control, and profit. But it's okay, because we're going to the moon.
One of the most important steps anyone can take in investing is figuring out how much risk they can handle. We use a tool called Riskalyze, which gives you a custom risk number between 0 and 100, with 100 being the riskiest asset you could have in your portfolio, and 1 being the least. In 5 minutes, we can tell you what your risk number is, and if you'd like, we can arrange to also tell you how much risk is in your portfolio, as well as what the hidden internal fees are, dividends are. This is incredibly valuable information you'll want to help prepare for your retirement. We know that not everyone who does this will become clients, but if you found this useful, please share this on your social media feeds. If you want to find out how much risk is in your portfolio, please email info@focalpointwealth.com or please call 480-771-PLAN or 7526. Thank you. Are you interested in learning more about your Social Security options? If so, we may have the perfect tool for you. You can get started by clicking on the banner ad above or the link below. From there, you simply enter your basic information and spouse information, if that applies. Next, enter your full retirement age benefit amount. Then, on the next screen, you can toggle your Social Security start date along with your spouse's to see how that affects your cumulative lifetime benefits. Finally, at the end, you will be able to see how much money you are potentially leaving on the table with your current selection. And if you'd like to schedule a free consultation where we can take a deeper dive into your Social Security options using the more advanced version of this tool, please leave your contact info on the final screen along with the best time to contact you. If you get to the end and don't want to be contacted, that's fine too, but we hope that if you found value in this tool, that you can share the page with a friend on your social media feeds to help spread the word. We appreciate you visiting our site, and we hope to earn your business someday. And remember, at Focal Point Wealth Management, your future is our focus. Over the last 9 years of my career as a financial planner, one common theme emerges amongst retirees. Tim, I wish I knew this information when I was starting out, because if I did, I would be in a much different place today. If you are a millennial or are close to one that you care about, please share millennialinvestorblog.com with them. Whether it's learning the differences between an IRA and Roth IRA, or the importance of saving early, we've got them covered. We also have a place for them to open up their own retirement accounts for as little as $5,000. If they want our help, we'd be more than happy to assist them, but if they want to do it on their own, then that's fine too. MillennialInvestorBlog.com, where millennials' future is our focus.